from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
A Caribbean educator makes his bid for leadership of UNESCO. An internal rift in St. Lucia's banana industry could have international implications, and why more than two dozen whales have beached themselves in Trinidad. I'm Jessica Robertson, and you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. The vice chairman of Trinidad and Tobago's National Commission for UNESCO, that's the United Nations Educational and Cultural Organization, is in the running for the position of director general. Current leader Federico Mayor steps down later this month, after 12 years at the helm. Lawrence Carrington is not currently labeled as a front-runner for the post. Of 11 candidates, the four being tipped as top contenders include Saudi Arabia's ambassador to London and the Egyptian vice president of the World Bank. Also in the race are Japan's ambassador to Paris and a former Australian foreign minister. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Carrington in Paris and asked him why, as an academic, he thinks he's the right man for the job.
UNESCO right now needs somebody who is detached from the power politics of the rest of the UN system and who can take a fresh look at a number of the problems that it has without being tied to any of the preconceived positions that people from more powerful nations have to deal with.
Now, detached from politics, but isn't this post still more diplomatic than academic?
There's no doubt that it does have a certain political component. You can't deny that. But I think that the perspective that you have to have must begin first within the intellectual role the organization has to play. The fact that so many people who are seeking the position come out of foreign ministries or diplomatic posts tells you something about the way in which the organization is being suborned into the general run-of-the-mill political kinds of operation of the UN system. And I think that that is precisely one of the difficulties that has been robbing the organization of fulfilling its potential.
You've received their backing, but how will CARICOM benefit as a regional bloc from having one of its own people at the helm?
I don't like to think in terms of any particular area of benefiting because of somebody from that area being the Director General of UNESCO, because it is precisely that kind of self-seeking approach that I would deprecate myself. I think that the CARICOM region would benefit simply by the importance that is attached to a national of one of its countries being in an influential position of that nature, and it will help to change people's attitudes towards small states like ours, which frequently have to fight twice as hard to get international recognition when it comes to competence in organizations of the kind, rather than any other sort of benefit. I certainly will not be looking around for every possible opportunity to, send a flow of money into CARICOM states or anything like that. That's unfair, because the operation is one that has to be governed by some notions of parity, some notions of priority, and considerations of fairness, regardless of what area is involved.
Professor Lawrence Carrington. The issue of good governance and the abolition of capital punishment are becoming familiar subjects at meetings involving the European Union. Both have come up for behind-the-scenes discussions at this week's EU-ACP conference in the Bahamas. This comes at a time when the European Union said it will sponsor a United Nations resolution opposing the death penalty. Emma Bonino is a former European commissioner and opposes hanging.
Well, I'm a citizen of the world campaigning for human rights or basic human rights. The fact is that the European Union is introducing as such a moratorium on a resolution at the General Assembly calling on a moratorium on capital punishment. And that will be debated and voted upon in November and December.
Well, one of the senior Caribbean diplomats attending the Nassau meeting is the OECS ambassador to Brussels, Edwin Laurent. I asked him why the EU is making such a big deal about good governance.
The issue of good governance is, of course, of great importance to everyone, both on the European side and on the ACP side. The reason why, though, it has become an issue right now is that in the mandate for the negotiations, the Commission wanted the inclusion of good governance as what it called an essential element which meant that if a country was in breach of the norms of good governance, then the cooperation would be ended. The ACP side, of course, do not accept that good governance should be an essential element and that a country should be punished if it is in breach of these norms. That is why there is the problem. I should emphasize, of course, that the ACP do not condone bad governance. What the ACP says is that often when a country's governance might not be good, it is often that it is weak governance rather than bad governance.
So there's a definite sense then that the Europeans want to link good governance to its future aid policy?
Well, that is the crux of the problem. The ACP side accepts that there needs to be proper management of EDF funding from the Europeans. The position of the ACP is that instead of making this the essential element in the negotiations, there should be some understanding between Europe and the ACP to fight against corruption and fraud and seek its elimination.
Now, Britain has already said that it will not link aid to the abolition of the death penalty, but do you get a feeling that the other EU states share a similar view?
Well, this has certainly not come up. It is not in the negotiations. The Europeans have not demanded the abolition of the death penalty as a condition for the continuation of aid.
OECS Ambassador to Brussels, Edwin Laurent. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. In St. Lucia, a leadership squabble in the banana industry has become a source of concern for the government, which says the situation could hamper international banana lobbying efforts. At the same time, banana industry sources say the dispute is bad for business. At issue are moves by a group of banana farmers to have chairman of the Banana Corporation, Patrick Joseph, removed. Ironically, the farmers belonged to an organization which Mr. Joseph formed. From Castries, Pete Nimbal reports.
Patrick Joseph, by his own admission, is a man who people love to hate. The outspoken former member of the United States military and the Banana Salvation Committee, which he helped form, came to prominence during the early 90s in a series of disruptive banana strikes to force change in the banana industry. The change they wanted came under the Labour Party government, with the privatization of the banana industry, with Mr. Joseph at the helm of the St. Lucia Banana Corporation. Today, a little over a year after the corporation was formed, the Banana Salvation Committee, which Mr. Joseph created, has turned against him. The man who now heads the committee, Fred Flood, is leading a group of farmers in a bid to have Mr. Joseph removed as chairman of the St. Lucia Banana Corporation. The charges the farmers have leveled at Mr. Joseph include mismanagement and arrogance in the discharge of his duties. There's another factor as well. Mr. Flood has said publicly that he is interested in Mr. Joseph's job. The issue of whether Mr. Joseph goes or stays will be settled on October 24th at an emergency shareholders meeting of the St. Lucia Banana Corporation. That's when shareholders will take a stand on a no-confidence motion in the SLBC chairman. Ahead of the vote, directors of the corporation have all tendered their resignation. Some have sought to link attempts to remove him to the political undercurrents that are ever-present in local bananas, orchestrated by elements who would be happy to see him go. This is Pete Ninval in Castries, St. Lucia for BBC Caribbean Report.
Meanwhile, the Windward Islands Banana Development Company says it will pay its first dividends to farmers since the body was set up 5 years ago. Farmers in the four islands will share almost $6 million EC dollars. In the case of St. Vincent, just over 3,000 banana producers will share $1.5 million. Cuba is facing the prospect of a major boycott by some of its Latin American partners who had earlier said they would attend the Ibero-American Summit in Havana next month. So far, at least four countries have served notice that they will not be represented at the two-day conference, which brings together representatives from Spain, Portugal, and the Caribbean. Washington has already distanced itself from being accused of advocating the boycott. Keith Stone Graves reports.
Washington, through its State Department spokesman James Rubin, said there's no need to advocate a boycott, as the countries who have said they intend to stay away from the Havana meeting don't need any help from the United States. The U.S. has never been part of the Ibero-American Forum, preferring to stick with the Organization of American States and its Summit of the Americas, from which Cuba is excluded. For a number of reasons, Chile, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Argentina have said they will not be represented in Havana, in what some observers see as a slap in the face for the Fidel Castro administration. A recent preparatory conference held in the Cuban capital also failed to attract a large gathering and consisted mainly of low-ranking officials from the invited nations. In the case of Chile, they said they would not attend in protest of Spain's intention to prosecute the former general Augusto Pinochet. In solidarity with Santiago, Argentina has also said it won't attend. And only last week, Nicaragua said that it will stay away from Havana so as to avoid endorsing a Cuban administration, which it has described as a 40-year dictatorship. The Costa Ricans have made their appearance conditional on its president, Miguel Ángel Rodríguez, being allowed to meet with Cuban dissidents. Professor Antonio Jorge is an international relations expert at Florida International University. He said that the countries are sending a clear signal to President Castro to clean up his act.
The presidents of these nations that are not attending have been quite explicit in their criticism of the Castro government. They've said explicitly that Castro has attended a number of summit conferences in the past and has committed himself to a gradual evolution towards a democratic regime and a market type of economy, and nonetheless he has failed to implement those promises.
According to Professor Jorge, the boycotting of the Havana conference by these countries will also have some implications for Cuba on the economic and trading fronts. He said this is bad news for the Cuban leader, especially at a time when the country is trying to attract external investments.
That was Keith Stonegraves reporting. In Guyana, officials of the main opposition People's National Congress on the Select Committee for Parliamentary Reform today walked out of a meeting in Georgetown. They've accused the government of deliberately delaying the process. The PNC has frequently made this accusation in the past, and the ruling People's Progressive Party has always denied it. Reform of the Constitution was one of the provisions in the peace accord worked out by CARICOM. Consensus by all the political parties on this is essential if the matter is to be settled. The sitting continued after the PNC walkout, with the chairman, Ripu Daman Persaud, ruling that all decision made will be provisional. In Trinidad, conservationists are trying to find out why 26 whales beached themselves on the island's northeastern Atlantic coast in an area called Manzanilla. They've been busy trying to get the animals back into the ocean, but 12 have died and the others were struggling to survive in shallow water. Our correspondent Tony Fraser reports from the scene of the rescue operation.
Well, we're on the beach here at Manzanilla. The scene is quite unusual. Thousands, literally thousands of people have been gathered here since early this morning. We understand that the first set of whales came in at about 5:30, 5:45 this morning, and they have been stuck on the beach here. A number of them, I've been seeing 6-7 of them have not been able to make it back out into the water. They are lying on the beach dead. A number of others are being treated by the villagers, attempting to get them back into the water. And it's quite a scene here. You have also something of a crane that is now being lodged here. I see it's going up in the air, and the people are attempting to put some cloths, big heavy blankets, under the whales to drag them back out into the water. We've been told that they are dolphin whales, and they may have come here through their pilot. Their pilot being disoriented and leading them onto the beach. And what has been happening is that as some of the villagers get a few of them back into the water, they're heading back to the beach because they are looking for a leader to take them out into the ocean.
And finally, the season's ninth tropical storm formed earlier today in the northwestern Caribbean. Tropical storm Irene has prompted the Cuban government to issue a hurricane watch for portions of the island. Forecasters say the storm is gaining strength and could threaten southwest Florida. The Cayman Islands government has already issued storm warnings, and Tropical Storm Irene is expected to produce heavy rains and gusty winds around some parts of Havana, Jamaica, and the Caymans. Well, that's it for BBC Caribbean Report. I'm Jessica Robertson, saying goodbye from London.